Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 88, where we are discussing Isabel Menzies' article, A Case Study in the Functioning of Social Systems as a Defense Against Anxiety, a report on a study of the nursing service of a general hospital, published in Human Relations in 1960. This is part one of the episode where we will discuss the case study and its backstory along with the major findings. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, I'm Sam. I'm calling from Mexico City.
And this is Pedro coming to you from Copenhagen.
And this is Catherine calling from the Midlands of England in Leamington Spa.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. Today we have a very, very interesting case study. This is titled A Case Study in the Functioning of Social Systems as a Defense Against Anxiety. And this is by Isabel E.P. Menzies. This comes from 1959. And it's a report, the subtitle is a report on the study of the nursing service of a general hospital. So this promises to be a very interesting and relevant topic for contemporary issues. So anybody want to take a stab at introducing us to the article?
Yes, I would be delighted. And I'm very excited for this episode, in part because we already heard a little bit about Isabel in the PDW we organized in the latest AOM conference. So first things, Isabel Menzies Leith, as she was later known, she was part of the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations. And again, we already had some episodes about Tavistock. So if you're curious, you can learn more from our previous episodes. But the story here in this paper is basically, as Tom said, it was a report from an action research, and the Tavistock was famous for conducting all types of applied research in which they collaborated with industry. And similar to other work they have done, such as the ones we covered in the case of Tristan Benford in the coal mines, basically the engagement started when the Tavistock was invited to try to make sense of problems that were happening in a nursing hospital in London. And as the research went forward, Isabel realized that what appeared to be the problem was actually just the symptom for something much bigger. And she goes on in this report to tell us on how she entered and tried to understand and make sense of what was originally a problem related to the staffing, in more particular to the fact that in this training hospital in London, they were having problems in trying to balance the tension between the priorities for teaching and priorities for the staffing for operations. And in the process, she realized that was a whole organizational system at play that, you know, underpinned this tension.
Yeah, and that was interesting to read, especially, you know, when we're talking about the tension between the teaching responsibilities and the practice responsibilities and how they conflicted. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, you can imagine just about any professional setting where you're trying to balance the needs of practice with that of teaching. And the cases that come walking in the door do not align with the needs of what it is that, say, a student is doing or learning about at a particular time. And it's easy to think of that being the problem. I mean, it's an efficiency problem in a way. But yeah, this case wound up delving much deeper, a much deeper problem. And this really was about how does people deal with anxiety? And as you can imagine, and as she runs through in extraordinary detail, the types of anxiety and the sources of anxiety that nurses encounter just in the ordinary course of their duties. Yeah, really went far afield from what it was that they were originally looking at.
At that time, the NHS, the National Health Service in England, was just 11 years into being in existence, you know. So it was actually a totally new system. At that time, they had a huge turnover of patients, lots of acutely ill patients, a range of illnesses, including new ones that they were dealing with, and an unpredictable variation in patient numbers. But I think it's fascinating read, because you could be reading about it now. It's hard to believe it's over 60 years ago what we're reading about in this. And I think it was the General Nursing Council that called Isabel Menzies-Leith to come in and look at it, the issue of dealing with how they could train students effectively, but also use them as a resource within the hospital as well. But that would have been quite a radical thing to do, I would imagine, at the time, to call in a psychoanalyst to come in and look at the problem and diagnose it. And we'll probably get into later on how she got on with doing that.
Yes, I think I found it particularly interesting how diving deeper into what the issue is by observing that even though the system seems to not have been working for a very long time, it's not really changing, right? So I thought that was a pretty interesting observation to kind of start with, and even as a reader to get you to wonder, okay, then what is it about the type of work and how they're handling and what the kind of needs that arise from doing that work that are, yeah, in a way shaping the system and then making it so hard to make changes that appear to be so obvious and necessary even to the managers.
So I think what is interesting in this case is that unlike the case that we covered on episode 34, which is also from a Tavistock in the case of the coal mines, in that case, it was about industrialization and how the arrival of industrialization had upset some of the social patterns that existed in the mine, and that led to all kinds of, you know, issues from high turnover to high absenteeism to general low morale, right? Here, the symptoms are similar, so the story starts in the same way, but as Sam was just saying, it seems that it is like a self-inflicted wound, so to speak. Because what Isabel does is to show that given the nature of work that nurses do, right, which is, of course, life and death and has all set of characteristics that, you know, tends to provoke anxiety, they have collectively and in a diffused way constructed a series of routines and practices through which they kind of alleviate. And then she goes on to in detail analyze them, and I'm sure we are going to unpack that in a second, and to show that while they promote some relief, they not really solve the core issue. Actually, they create some new forms of anxiety and do not allow the nurses to develop skills to handle it, but rather just to avoid it. And in a way, it creates a self-sustaining mechanism that prevents change from happening, right? So it's a very interesting analysis that she makes, because she's able to show that not only what appear to be a small thing like staffing patterns actually reveals something else, but also change was not so easy to accomplish because there was a set of practice and relationships in place that pushed it back, so to speak, right? That prevented the people in the system to gain the necessary awareness and then the buy-in in the potential change initiative.
It is like a classic, again, another classic study in change management gone wrong, isn't it? Because it ultimately failed, I think it's fair to say, and it wasn't successful whatsoever. And I read a little bit about in and around in the years that came after the publication of the paper, and Isabel Menzies-Leith, I think, was personally very disappointed in what happened in the end, without spoiling the end of it, which we'll get to. But, you know, the two kind of initiatives that happened didn't take off whatsoever, and ultimately nothing changed. And I think if you were to read it with the lens of 2022, it's probably similar challenges being faced in many nursing hospitals today still. Anyway, that's a slightly depressing view of it, but there you go. That's my depressed view of change.
Well, it is what it is, because you know she also gets to some of the those self-perpetuating aspects. She talks about how these defense mechanisms becomes part of the socialization, and that also speaks to a different study, or a different episode that we covered, Van Manen and the police socialization. There's a lot of similarities that we'll get to, but also how in this particular case, it really colored this recognition of how these defenses work against anxiety, really colored the way that nursing students came to grips with the differences between their beliefs, what their expectations were of serving as a nurse against this, rather harsh reality. And she made a lot of points about that, because it's part of the reason, I think, that these nursing students were leaving in greater numbers than one would hope, that those expectations were being not met. Can we go right into the structure of the article and some of the particulars? Because the article was very, very clearly written to show, basically the end result. It doesn't. So she starts with, the background about the teaching hospital and the problem they were originally brought in. And then right up front is when she talks about the nature of anxiety. And it is an interesting read, because it's one of those cases where you're bringing in this whole other stream of literature to try to define a term that nowadays we might see an organizational studies definition of it, or something that's very particular to the field or subfield involved. But she's bringing in what was the extant literature at the time about what is anxiety and where does it come from. Then she gets into how it appears, or basically how it manifests among the nursing students. What is anxieties are felt by the nurses, and then where the meat of the article really starts to come in is around page 100, when she starts to lay down all of the defensive techniques, and I think I counted about 8 of them. I mean, a whole bunch of different techniques that are used to try to help nurses in the general case deal with anxiety and how it manifests itself as a system or a defensive mechanism that is writ large across the nursing. Just the first, I'll talk about the first one, and then we can bounce around however we wish. The first one was splitting up the nurse-patient relationship. Now, you can imagine the typical person who wants to get into the nurse corps is probably doing so because they're passionate about caring for people. It's one of the draws of being in the field of medicine and being in many of other professional fields, is that sense of service, that sense of belief that you're helping people, helping humanity, whatever it is. But what's interesting is that because of the nature of the anxiety by which nurses can become so overwhelmed due to the personal relationship that they may draw with a patient, that the system, the defense mechanism, is to sever, or what she says, split that relationship. And so they do things like rotate nurses among patients so that you don't have the opportunity to build that bond. You're just providing the service, say, mechanically. And that way you avoid being so attached to a patient that you don't feel distress or distraught when the patient's situation takes a downward turn. Really fascinating, and how that completely conflicts or collides with this idea of a calling or of service is just very fascinating.
Yeah, and I think the next defensive technique is depersonalization, categorization, denial of the significance of the individual. And I love that phrase that was used, which I have heard similar ones in medical settings, the liver in bed 10. It's so dehumanizing. Interestingly, she touches also on, that artifact and symbolism of the uniform as an agglomeration of nursing skills. She describes it as without individuality as well, and the role that that has to play. It's interesting in you talking about the type of individual who would be attracted to become a nurse, Tom, as well, because I think later on in the article, she talks about their, either official or unofficial recruitment policy of looking for, in particular, mature individuals. And what often happened is the type of person who had applied to become a nurse, who was mature and quite steady in their outlook on life, was quite shocked by being in this role of a student nurse, where I think it was just 6 months of your 3-year training was actually studying, and you were practically doing very basic tasks, and not allowed to flourish whatsoever and to develop yourself. And resulted in, I think it was 30 to 50% of them leaving before the end of it. So that was also failing. But, you know, it's not what you expect, as you say, going into a caring profession, that you'd have to depersonalize people, and as well detaching and denial of feelings, I think, is the third defensive technique. It's interesting as well that the senior staff really believe that the students could detach if they were given enough experience, that somehow by exposure to the role would actually cause them to deny their feelings. There was also a part of that element, as always, talks about the panic around emotional outbursts, and we see that in many workplaces anyway, and just the lack of containment. Maybe we'll talk about containment and emotions at work anyway later. And that expectation of repression of feelings as well. The more it gets into these defensive techniques, the more dehumanizing the whole process is, really. And that dismissal by a member of the senior staff says, you know, anyway, the students won't come to us.
Yeah, I don't know if you felt the same, but as you kind of start going through the techniques, like at first they kind of make sense in a way. You know, it's okay, it's not ideal, but it seems like a functional way to deal with the complexity of the task, which she really gets into in the part which explains the anxiety. But then they start to become or appear less functional, like as you keep going down the list. And then, I mean, she does get into in the next section about these are not really ways of dealing with anxiety, but they're ways of avoiding it. And then so they end up, you know, causing all these other problems. But yeah, I was kind of making like a list as I went through these techniques of what appears to be functional or non-functional. And I was surprised how, you know, when you get to the end of the list, you kind of start wondering, why are they even, you know, doing this or keep doing this? Because in a way, it seems that they're, even if they are recruiting these nurses that have, you know, that are mature or that have this kind of vocation, it seems that they're trying to, you know, bring them down in a way. And yeah, like under, keep their skills and their emotional skills like underdeveloped.
So I actually had, perhaps unsurprisingly, a different take on that, right? Because I think I was at first surprised to see the amount of problems beyond the actual work that nurses need to do, the stuff they need to face, right? I never paused to think about that. But of course, dealing with life and death and suffering must create a lot of anxiety and be, you know, emotionally challenging. But I also see now she talks about all sorts of demands and critiques that both patients and family of patients lay on nurses, how they many times start to shift responsibility to the nurses in making decisions, you know. So it's, I never pause to imagine that, how much gets pushed on their plate, so to speak, which made me appreciate actually some of the techniques, right? As Sam was saying, I also had the feeling that some of them made perfect sense. And I think we see them in different type of professions, especially the ones related to this necessary separation. You know, if you think about doctors, it's similar, right? How, I mean, you know, I think any kind of professional setting, you know, lawyers, accountants, whatever, like, it, or even people that are just handling customers, street level bureaucrats, or people in any kind of interaction service role, right? So some kind of separation is necessary. Some kind of standardization needs to, you know, allows you to see your task as separate from yourself. And that can be positive to some extent, right? Because you feel and you can be accountable according to what has been decided, so to speak, right? What has been agreed upon is the way to handle such situations, right? So having routines and protocols, we know, have this important role. But at the same time, what seems to create the problems that she is dissatisfied with or pointing to the dysfunctions is one that the standardization is excessive to the point there is no room for flexibilization, discretion, and how that's important. And she cites early work that's talking about that, right? And she also tries to show that while it's important to have this kind of separation and the uniforms that Catherine was talking about, the sense of, you know, being regimented into a role. The problem there seems to be as well that there is no sense of esprit de corps or teamwork or general sense of being in this together, right? So, and what's interesting is that it shows that how that matters, right, for work to be accomplished is the social ties. And it's something that the Tavistock has, you know, from work in other settings, they have shown to us that the mirage of Taylorism and just giving people a task to do and ignoring that the social ties matter, you know, will necessarily create all kinds of dysfunctions and frustrations, etc. And this seems to be another example we see that, right? The problem becomes not just because there is a standardization, because there is a separation, but because there is no discretion and no way for these nurses to create the tasks that are needed in order to coordinate together the work that needs to be done.
I'm also reminded of the episode we did before on the managed heart by Arlie Hochschild. This is a study of emotional labor, and I think this is a good case study of emotional labor. When we think about those, interactions with families is where this really comes in. Because you can imagine that for nurses dealing with this over the course of 25 years or 30 years of dealing with patients, dealing with families or whatever, that there comes that point where you've seen it all before and you rely on the mechanisms to protect you from anxiety. Whereas for many families, this may very well be the first time they've ever dealt with a significant health issue among their family members. They're scared, they're overwhelmed. And of course, you know, unfortunately, sometimes a nurse's responsibilities, as Isabel points out, is basically to be the dumping ground of all of the emotions that that are pent up and all of those fears and what have you. And you've got to be able to exercise that emotional labor and play the role of we care, we get it, we're under, you know, we have things under control, or we're doing the best we can, or whatever it is, without taking it all personally. And boy, is that's hard for anybody. That's hard for anybody. And for them to develop those mechanisms, yeah, it's on the surface, it certainly sounds dysfunctional in a way, because emotional connection is, which just seems so important, but you can't have it. There's got to be a limit.
This is definitely a case of emotional labor, but I don't know. I kept thinking about like studies that I've done as well, that is work that doesn't involve emotional labor, but it does involve a lot of uncertainty or ambiguity. And I could kind of think of examples in a way that people do the same thing. Like they kind of try and distance themselves. They try to create symbolic boundaries. I think this is definitely a case of emotional labor, but we can think of other cases. Maybe you thought as well of studies that you're familiar with or that you've done where you see this kind of anxiety coming from maybe things other than direct contact with, you know, people or services or whatever. That you also can think of the way, okay, then this culture and these things that maybe don't make sense in a functional sense, or how we ideally would expect the organization or the workers to do their jobs, maybe we can explain it because it's a way for them to cope, either avoid or solve or confront the anxieties of their own tasks.
Yeah, I would say, you know, in my own work as a consultant, you know, there is an element of detachment required to get the job done. And I work in the not-for-profit sector, so some of the causes that I work with are highly emotive. To get the job done, you need to feel an element of empathy to the cause and understanding of the cause, and that needs to authentically come through your work. But also, you do need healthy boundaries. But I think what this case study shows is how it can be taken to an extreme level, the detachment, and how detrimental that is. There are healthy ways of getting a job done. And as Pedro said, you know, having task lists and having processes in place sometimes are a comfort and enable you to relax and get the job done. You know, at the end of the day, as a minimum, you did your job today. But it sounds like in this case study that it is to an extreme level, that the dehumanizing of the individual and the nurses themselves and the student nurses in particular is to an extreme, and it doesn't quite get addressed in this one. I have to say, as a manager myself, the bit that was kind of screaming out to me, if they could just bend a little bit and allow a little bit of discretion, I think Pedro mentioned it already, and a little bit of autonomy that people could, you know, take a little bit of control back, it might have made a difference. I don't know.
Well, what I wonder is to what extent is this indicative of the hospital setting vice other medical settings? I'll lay my own personal experience because my parents, I've watched my parents take care of my grandmother during her last days. We had a whole team of nurses who were dedicated to that particular type of a mission. And the experience struck me as the polar opposite of some of these. So, for example, there was definitely direct personal contact on a very, very regular basis with my parents, with the patient, my grandmother. And going down to one which I'd love to delve into if we can, this notion of deprivation of personal satisfactions, which she addressed in page 113. In the case study, basically the nurses, not only are they somewhat suppressed in terms of their ability to express or to emote their feelings as they're going through this, they don't get very much satisfaction. They don't get, you know, the system seems to be preventative of the nurses getting a pat on the back or feeling satisfaction for what they did. It's a way of trying to prevent that emotional impact that could very well lead to further anxiety down the road. But personal satisfaction still ultimately are meaningful. That, you know, the sense that somebody is doing a good job in order to prevent them from getting burned out or whatever. The nurses dealing with my grandmother's situation, they're ones who are dealing with families who are at the very, very end of the life of a loved one. And so anxiety of the family is very, very high. And yet generally, because of the intimate contact, the family that you hope, the family shows a lot of gratitude. And it's a very, very different experience than what is sounding like, you know, for a large hospital. Those two extremes are suggestive that the environment really does have something significant to do with the intensity of these defense mechanisms. Because, of course, the nurses in my situation, you know, my case I'm talking about, they feel anxiety too, no doubt. But the different social defenses are apparent.
So I think that here we start to think about variation in time and in space, right? And maybe we can unpack that as we go forward, because, of course, nursing changed in the past decades. But in that context, looking back, I think Isabel tries to reflect exactly why is that, even though things are very standardized, nurses never feel that they have accomplished their work, right? What Catherine was saying, that in principle, if you have routines and procedures, you're going to feel that you have done the job. And as Tom was saying, in principle, if the job is so standardized, you also feel that when things go well, a sense of satisfaction, right? You would see the products of your labor. But those things are missing, right? And then that's, I think, when the analysis becomes enlightening, because that she shows things that we don't know, I think, so much from previous studies. She shows the importance of, in a way, having some stability in the work context, right? And having awareness of how the different tasks are being done and who is doing what in that moment, right? Because as she says, it seems that this organization is in a perpetual firefighting state in which nurses are moving around all the time. There is no sense of planning. It could be just because, as Catherine was saying, the NHS had recently been created, so all these interdependencies across hospitals are probably being worked out. So the input this hospital is getting is probably, you know, changing all the time. But there seems to be this problem that these nurses are unable to have a sense of what is everyone around them doing. What is their general work environment, right? And then that is one of the interesting things she says that's related to the defense mechanism is that there is no sense of clear responsibility, right? Because things are being pushed all the time and what is being asked to them, it's basically just to be obedient, right? And to be ultra stickler for rules and the procedures, right? Without a sense of what are these trying to accomplish? So in this weird cocktail, we get that we have maybe the worst of both worlds. We have a very regimented type of space with a neat separation between the person and the professional, but without all the things that such more bureaucratic system usually brings, which is a sense of stability, a sense of understanding, a sense of interdependencies, right?
I wonder if it's a thing that's particular to the medical profession. What you were saying there, Pedro, about delegation of responsibility. It's interesting in the medical model to see the delegation upwards with the nurses as well, and that diffusion upwards. You know, you can almost hear that phrase, it's beyond my pay grade to do this, when you're reading it. And perhaps that's in other areas as well, I'm not sure.
But I think that the problem there is that they are not able to answer whose pay grade it is.
Yes. And understandably, one of the defense techniques then is avoidance of change, because if you're trying to exist and work in such an unsatisfactory way, it's no surprise, really, is it, that change is only initiated at the point of crisis for the nurses, that, you know, they're not going to embrace it working in that kind of setting the best of times, because it's you know, if your anxiety is at high levels anyway, you're not going to embrace change or feel secure enough to, for all the Freudian reasons as well, which we can't avoid in reading this as well.
You know what I thought about that? We are getting ahead in the paper, right? But because she's quite critical of that. She basically says that, of course, people are going to avoid change because they have, change brings the unknown, and these people are very, you know, anxious prone. And therefore, there is, you know, all this, and there's also the incentives in the way the system is set up to try to erode it. But is there more sociological about that? Because I don't know how the nursing was 30 years before, but I suspect that all these task lists and unclear responsibilities and lack of discretions did not always exist, right? This sounds very much typical things from Taylorism, formalization, organizations grow, hospitals grow. You can imagine if the NHS is being established, there is a sense of this kind of early industrialization trend, which is pushing for that. So maybe it's not just because they are irrationally, quote unquote, against change, but because the change they have recently experienced, an erosion of social ties, an erosion of discretion, an erosion of some kind of predictability about the work that they're accomplishing.
I am wondering, I mean, I don't know this for a fact, but it would be easy to get an impression that actually these were very, very long-standing challenges, because we think about just the practice of medicine, say, at the beginning of the 20th century, and the days of, you know, huge pandemics and some of the other kind of emergencies that nations have had to grapple with, you know, Spanish flu and pandemic. A lot of current discourse has been reaching back to the Spanish flu and saying, you know, what do we learn from that for present day? Well, you know, when you're talking about mass casualties, you know, wars and all those sorts of things. Yeah, resilience, you know, any way you want to describe it, of basically mechanisms that which the nurses, who were not, I don't believe they professionalized until much later, but, you know, nurses at the time were basically taking on some massive responsibilities, and they had to put up those same types of defenses, or at least have the defenses for the same type of purpose, to try to allow them to get through. And in that time, you know, in the days before modern vaccines and modern protective measures, nurses were very much at personal risk in trying to treat patients. We have the ability to mitigate that risk nowadays with modern technologies. They didn't have that a century ago. So, the personal risk was very, very real. Yeah, I can't say this definitively, but I'm pretty sure that there was a lot in common. I don't think that this was a truly new phenomenon.
I agree. And I think with kind of lagging that we were going through each of the defense mechanisms and going back to the point of, you know, maybe we feel some of them were justified and maybe even functional and maybe they still exist today because of those reasons, while others don't. And I don't know what your kind of general read, like going through these 10 defense mechanisms is, but to me, it seemed, and this might be my bias in favor of bureaucracy. but it seemed that all the defense mechanisms that were about, like, you know, taking a little bit the emotional burden or not, you know, establishing some boundaries between what we know are the personal and emotional aspects of the work and what tasks actually need to get done, or that, you know, the whole like ritualization of tasks, standardization, not putting all the weight of the decision making or the responsibility in one person, but making it more distributed. Like, those didn't seem to be too bad for me, actually. Whereas all the ones that were about denying the nature of the work, so the denying feelings, or, you know, the whole like kind of blaming each other between the nurses that were a little bit ahead on the hierarchy, or underestimating, you know, the capacities of nurses, or denying them with the joy of having done the task right. Like, those kinds of things that were about denying the emotional and kind of trying to erase it, those seem to be very clearly negative. So I don't know if you had a similar kind of reading going through the defense mechanisms.
Yeah, definitely. That, you know, there's a healthy balance, isn't there, between both. But I think what we're getting an example of here is where it's too much towards one particular one, where there's the denial of the emotions and the individual entirely, which, interestingly, she says these defense techniques are created by the individual rather than the institution. But by accepting it, is the institution colluding in it? Do you know what you think?
I had a similar sense, right? And I think that maybe, and this is one of my critiques to the tanks, if any, is that while I think Isabel does a great job at identifying all of this system, right? I don't believe that necessarily all of them have the same source. And of course, she's trying to make an argument and she has an agenda here, of course. She wants to legitimize and show the power of psychological theories, right? So she tries to wrap everything around that, which, you know, was important back then. So I'm sure she's overemphasizing and trying to create a coherent narrative. But as I was trying to say before, I imagine that some of them emerge for different reasons and they emerge in relationships for different challenges, right? And some of them, as you were saying, are still with us. There's probably a reason. While others are idiosyncratic and particular to the problems, or particular to the problems and reinforcing the problems that was happening in this organization, or at least in the NHS at that time, right? So I think it's important to look back and try to look at them with a more analytical eye, in trying to see exactly that some of the things that she's talking about is still important, is just like on a surface level related to the problem. The order seems to be the core, so to speak, causes, right?
Yeah, in addition, I think the part that strikes me as most powerful in this is to understand and unpack the shock that's felt by the nursing students. Because I think the things that we probably are a little bit more inclined to consider to be at least normative or acceptable, or, you know, understandable at least, happen to be the ones that I think Isabel spent the least amount of time on. And that's because they're the ones that were perhaps less shocking as a nurse student goes in and observes what's going on and comes to grips with the difference between their going in perception, their going in idealism in some sense, versus what they're seeing in the reality. And the ones that Isabel spent the greatest amount of time on were the ones that make much less sense, or harder for, say, a newbie going into this setting to understand. And that, in particular, was the case of the last one that she addressed, deprivation of personal satisfactions, which she spent a lot of time talking about, because there, I highlighted this particular quote on page 114. "The lack of personal support and help is particularly painful for the student nurse as she watches the care and attention given to patients. It is our impression that a significant number of nurses enter the profession under a certain confusion about their future roles and functions. They perceive the hospital as an organization particularly well-equipped to deal with dependency needs, kind and supportive, and they expect to have the privilege of being very dependent themselves. However, because of the categorization, they find that they are denied the privilege except on very rare occasions." Yeah, I too read this read these defense mechanisms and came away with that impression that, okay, this is particularly dysfunctional under any circumstance, that when if an individual is being shocked to their core, like at entry level, then this is a barrier. This is a barrier to joining the profession. This is something that the institution has to address. Otherwise, it will become a systematic problem down the road, because people will be less likely to want to go into the profession because they know what they're getting themselves into.
You know, I agree fully. And when I read it, I don't know much about the history of nursing, but a lot of the patterns she describes made up me feel of the worst stereotypical case of a macho organization, right? Because the story seems to be, here's your rifle, go to the war now, right? Because there's so much turnover, so many people quit, don't finish the course, you know, and there is no praise that is given. So besides what you just said, right, there is no sense of satisfaction, but even on a daily basis, there is no sense of appraisal, only demanded obedience and continuous scrutiny of the quality of the work. That made me think that a lot of the things we take for granted today had to emerge at some point, right? And had to emerge as organizations started to be concerned about being more efficient and reliable, and that there is not endless staffing numbers of people, right? That you need to, I don't know. And I also think maybe the expectations of people at work and workers' rights and all kinds of mobilization from workers in what is acceptable, what is not. And you can see that there is none of the HR basic systems we are so familiar with seem to exist. You know, we had an episode about jobs and job crafting. None of that seems to exist here, right? Any kind of sense of HR policies, system of appraisals, yearly revisions, you know, seems to exist here. Any kind of attempt to develop a sense of culture or of cohesion, even just the fact, understanding what is the output or common goal for which this organization is trying to, you know, do the work, right? You can imagine that at that point, that's exactly what is happening, because Britain, for example, and many other parts were going through this kind of rapid changes and destabilizations, moves in which, you know, industrialization was bringing. So the social fabric at work that was common had been eroded, but something else had not been built, right? And we see exactly, I think, that in the case.
I like that description, because you struck another phrase that came to my mind, was rite of passage. There are plenty of organizations, plenty of institutions, and plenty of professions who establish rites of passage precisely to deliver a shock to the system, to ensure that a new member demonstrates loyalty to the institution or organization. Now, it's healthy if that the failure to do the shock, the failure to go through this rite of passage, means that an individual is unready to perform what the organization expects. And it's unhealthy if that rite of passage is for its own ends, just basically as a way of beating down somebody or exhibiting power. So it's a very, very dangerous thing. I don't think that this particular case is illustrating a deliberate rite of passage. As a matter of fact, if there was one, it probably would alleviate some of these sorts of anxieties, because then there would be a sense of a systematic process of getting somebody ready to join, as opposed to just, oh, here you are. Oh, man, this is totally different than what I expected. And people start leaving. It would be very, very different.
Should we say here the end of the paper, so to speak, right?
Yeah, let's do that.
So we talked about the challenges and the context and the mechanisms that Isabel identifies, and to what extent some of them can be related to different causes, more or less functional, and so on, right? But I think what is interesting is that she goes on to show that actually all of this only alleviates the problem, or is a temporary fix, like a Band-Aid, right? Because, as Sam was just saying, it does not allow the nurses to learn how to deal with the anxiety and the different situations that make them emerge, but just try to, you know, push them aside, so to speak, right? And perhaps is the most important thing in the argument, it prevents change from happening, right? So in a way, it creates a self-fulfilling mechanism. And towards the paper, she's very critical because she says that it seems that the ironic sad part is that it ends up driving away the best capable candidate, right? As Som was just saying, because there is no rite of passage, there is no system for which to balance expectations and introduce people properly, right? It ends up just pushing aside the people that would in principle have the strongest sense of professional vocation, right? Which therefore doesn't allow the system to change, so to speak, to have the necessary energy and perspectives that would be the ones that could ameliorate the situation.
Isabel says in, or outlines in her conclusion, that the social defense system did not work as a bulwark against anxiety. And it didn't help them to work through it either, nor did it help in their organization of tasks. And she talks about how the task performance element continued, but it was suboptimal. So even that didn't necessarily benefit from the way that work was organized. Also, it's interesting, they mentioned as well that the low morale amongst the nurses impacted on the recovery rates of the patients as well, which I thought was quite sad. So ultimately, it wasn't the answer. And she does talk about how perhaps after she left, she doesn't say explicitly that it was a recommendation of hers, but they did look at doing more training for nurses. And they also thought about running essentially a pilot program where they would distribute tasks differently and try it in a different way. But I think at the time of writing it, neither of those things had actually happened or come to fruition. So it kind of ends on a slightly depressing note, the paper, I think. You know, she obviously went on to write much more on this topic. And interestingly, going back, Tom, to what you said about your own family's personal experience of palliative care, you know, and that one-to-one relationship, she took a lot of pride from a piece of work she did where she did a research project looking at children who were in residential institutions and how important the care was of one individual caregiver, that your care was managed by one individual person. So, you know, basically the opposite of what she saw in the hospital in London. So there was a slightly happier end to it, but I think the paper ends in a slightly depressing note. Maybe that's just my reading of it.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.